Turning our attention now to rural communities, we'll take a look at energy needs. We'll take a look at resource conservation. And as it relates to the 2007 Farm Bill, with Brad Redlin. Brad with us by phone, Director of Agricultural Programs with the Isaac Walton League of America. He's based in St. Paul, Minnesota, but he still finds time to maintain the family farm near Sydney, Montana, with his six brothers and sisters. Brad's a former high school teacher, editor, and federal policy analyst for the Center for Rural Affairs in Lyons, Nebraska. Always a pleasure to have someone with his credentials on, and certainly big topic to deal with here. And we'll look forward to your calls as well. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And we welcome to the phones and to the program today, Brad Redlin. Brad, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, Larry, I really appreciate the invite. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about the Isaac Walton League just to start things out here of America. It's been around for 80 years, something like that?
Yeah, we're in our 85th year right now.
And I think I know who Isaac Walton was, but who was Isaac Walton and what are some of the league's current activities?
Oh, Isaac Walton, he was a 17th century fisherman and a bit of a philosopher. He wrote a book called The Complete Angler and kind of set a criteria for conservation and fisherman guide that's withstood decades and, in fact, centuries of support. So that's where the name comes from. Isaac Walton, he was actually founded, like I said, 85 years ago in 1922 amongst some fishermen that were focused really in our part of the country here. They really came together around the upper Mississippi River between Wisconsin and southern Minnesota. And in fact, in 1924, the first primary victory for the Isaac Walton League was the establishment of the Upper Mississippi Fish and Wildlife Refuge, which was signed into law by the pandem from the president that's hanging outside my office here. So we've had a long history of doing conservation in this part of the country and, for that matter, all over the country.
Well, you know, and when you talk about the Farm Bill, you know, it not only affects farmers, but it really affects production. It affects farmers, obviously, rural economies, conservation, certainly.
Well, it really does. And the thing that I always say about the Farm Bill, I mean, this is a huge piece of legislation. It's an omnibus bill. It has, you know, all kinds of sections, which they call titles, but and it comes around about every 5 years for reauthorization. And the thing to remember about that is that 52% of the land in the United States is in agricultural use. So when you have a bill of this size covering that kind of magnitude of the actual geography of our country, I assert there's no other bill in Congress that has a greater impact on the soil, on the waters, on the air of the United States than the Farm Bill.
And just to mention, the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, has been in some danger.
It's had a fitful spring here this year. We have a real successful program in the Conservation Reserve Program. This pays farmers to idle land that is not good use for production to begin with. It's too hilly, it's too wet, or it has really important wildlife benefits. And what the Conservation Reserve Program has done in its history over the 25 years it's been around, that we've found incredible advances in terms of protecting water quality, certainly protecting the soil quality, and not to mention the really productive wildlife benefits that have come off that land. Unfortunately, it's being looked at right now because it is land that is not being currently farmed, and this is where the energy boom is coming into this in terms of the ethanol. And it's kind of a two-front thing when you talk about the Conservation Reserve Program, too. Most immediately, you know, we're all seeing the headlines about corn ethanol and the tremendous expansion that it's seeing right now. And that is putting pressure then on people taking that land that might be seeded into perennial covers right now under their CRP contracts and breaking that back out and putting corn in it. Concern there, obviously, if that is particularly highly erodible and sensitive land, we don't want to see that particularly happen. And the other side of it is, too, there's also this brave new world, this new opportunity in what people are calling the cellulosic ethanol production, or this is deriving ethanol from plant species and woody biomass and these other sources that are good in the advantage that they provide in being being natural to environments, you know, native prairie grass species. But we don't want to see reserve acres that are in contract under the Conservation Reserve Program become kind of backdoor production acres by being utilized for grass sources for that type of ethanol production either.
Yeah. Brad Redlin, our guest today, Director of Ag Programs with the Isaac Walton League of America, as we talk with him today about rural communities, energy needs, resource conservation, the 2007 Farm Bill. If you'd like to join in with your own questions or comments, feel free at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Well, what the status on that CRP is, what is it status? It's sort of, I think it survived, did it not?
Yes, it does. It's still in existence. We have a couple big things happen with the CRP most recently. One of the things was that the contracts that are signed on the CRP last 10 to 15 years, and there was an expiration period from 2007 to 2010 that was going to see out of 36 million acres that were in the program prior to 2007,
yeah,
28 million of those acres were coming up for expiring contracts within that time period, the 2007 to 2010 time period. The re-enrollments and extension opportunities were just given to farmers that were holders of those expiring contracts. And USDA announced here just a few short weeks ago that 80% of those contract holders are renewing the land, their contracts and their CRP. So we've retained 80% of that almost 27, 28 million acres that could have been expired. So that was good news. The bad news side of the equation is that USDA themselves, largely in response to the pressure that corn prices, frankly, are driving for increased corn production, not so much necessarily even ethanol demand, but actually the price demand, has offered to not conduct any more additional sign-ups. So where we did not get about 4 million acres out of those 27, 28 million acres re-enrolled, unfortunately now USDA is not conducting a sign-up this year for certain, and maybe not even next year, maybe not even 2008, to actually regain some of that acreage that was lost.
Hmm. So, and that's obviously a concern from your point of view.
Well, it is, and it's a concern that isn't quite as simple as just, you know, return each acre that's currently contracted, because there's a valid point to be made that some contracts were written in years ago that may have not really been as well suited for targeting wildlife habitat, or as well suited as targeting highly erodible land as it may have been. It may have been land that does have some legitimate production capacity.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we'd like to see a sign up, because from coast to coast, we're convinced that there is at least 39 million, which is the actual statutory cap of acres on the CRP program right now. We're convinced that from coast to coast, we could find 39 million acres in the United States that should not be in production right now, that is eroding excessively, or that is really more valuable for habitat than for minimal agriculture production. So the concern is that not necessarily that a given contract or a given field or acres are not being re-enrolled, but the fact is that it's not providing the opportunity for, you know, very necessary acres elsewhere to be enrolled.
Yeah. Well, let's take some calls. Lots of people to visit with you. Sharon in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for calling. I came in a little late. My question has been with the ethanol production, which I think is a great idea for alternative energy, but it takes a lot of energy to get that far. You know, the tractors need oil, et cetera. And I just don't know where the trade-off is. Are we actually, do we have a net surplus here that's going to save us money and energy?
Yeah, that's a great point, and a huge point of discussion certainly is the net energy balance of ethanol. And it has received a lot of analysis. We've, in putting together our farm bill analysis and platform, we certainly looked very closely at that. And we kind of came to was the consensus agreement amongst the scientific community is that there is, in fact, an energy gain by producing ethanol, in fact. In other words, it's saying you're not losing or putting more energy into producing it than you're getting out. It's not a huge gain right now. It's like a 1.2 ratio kind of thing. But it's not actually a losing proposition to begin with. There are still some out there that are disputing those figures, but as far as a complete consensus examination of all the literature and studies that are out there, they do confirm that there is gain, and it seems to be improving. The trend line is that they're getting better at it and getting more energy out of it. So that concern is somewhat addressed, but there are certainly myriad others involving the energy use and the water use that does all.
Yep.
Become components of ethanol production in the individual neighborhood plants.
Yeah. Sharon, thanks. Mark and Baraboo, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've been involved in the CRP issue a bit, and I hope you can help shed some light on a couple of things. I've noticed the pattern of trying to discourage CRP participation. Partly it was the sudden re-enrollment for 3 years that they announced last spring, and you only had about a month or so to make your mind up. Partly it's the lack of new sign-ups that you mentioned, but partly there are some new standards here, at least in Wisconsin, that are very onerous and really haven't been put in place before. Part of the signing up for new contracts is that you now have to meet new standards, such as if you planted trees, you have to have a certain number of trees surviving, whereas they don't seem to have any established standard. In fact, they've talked to DNR Forestry in the last year about establishing standards, but they're claiming that they've always had these standards.
And, and there's more to talk about relating to this. And I hope you can hang on there, Mark. And certainly Brad Redlin is going to be hanging on as well. And we'll have a chance to take up this issue with him and many more issues as well right after a look at the news. Please stay with us. Happy to have you along here on The Ideas. Nat, Larry Mueller here. We're talking about rural communities, energy needs, resource conservation, the 2007 Farm Bill. That affects everybody. Affects you, affects me, affects everybody here in not only in Wisconsin, but across the country. Brad Redlin, our guest, Director of Agricultural Programs with the Isaac Walton League of America. Our guest, pleased to have him along. And certainly if you want to join in with your own comment or question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Brad, as we broke for news, when Mark from Baraboo was on, was talking about the sort of the short sign-up times for CRP. He was talking about new standards or different standards might make it more difficult to qualify. Comments on that?
Yeah, well, I appreciated Mark's call and Mark's insight on that and, kind of experiencing it on the ground himself. And that he makes obviously a very valid point. There are some real challenges that were addressed during this re-enrollment process that was coming up when we saw this huge expiration of acreage, that 28 million out of the 36 million total nationwide that was coming up for re-enrollment. There was a process USDA initiated to just try to determine under what criteria that re-enrollment was going to take place. How would they grade the land? How would they prioritize one particular contract over another? It was a bit of a fitful process. I don't think that anyone would probably regard it as a perfect result, but it could have been worse. There's one way we could look at it, the Isaac Walton League, is that they did come out as prioritizing that land, which was most sensitive and most important for wildlife habitat, that sort of thing. The nuances, the particulars, like he's talking about with established tree growth and that sort of thing, those become really problematic difficulties because they're not related to really a broader conservation thing. They're nitpicky, in a word, frankly, is one way of describing it. The effort, though, nonetheless, was by and large greeted pretty well from us in the league. That it did prioritize land. It did provide the opportunity for people to re-enroll their land, and it did so in spite of all the efforts that were being heard already and are certainly still being heard to really reduce the program overall. Some are asking for it to be canceled entirely, that it is just getting in the way of agriculture production that needs to expand. And that was one of the things, frankly, that USDA was making determination on this spring, whether or not they were going to provide free opt-outs of people in the middle of existing contracts to provide them an opportunity to have kind of a no-fault cancellation of the contract and put that land into production. The good news on that was that for this year, Secretary Johans, USDA Secretary Johans, says that he won't be doing any of that. He won't be authorizing any no-fault opt-outs, which is good news. We don't know, and he held open the possibility of doing it in future years, and we certainly don't think that there's any need for that, and particularly when you look at the fact that we just had $28 million out of $36 million come in for expiration. Any opportunity for opt-out was certainly abundant at that time, and
yeah.
And 80% chose not to do so. So I think that fight's already been had, and I don't think that there should be any more discussion on it, frankly.
Mark, I thank you again for calling. Beth in Appleton, I want to give you a chance. Beth, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I just got out of the forum that Representative Steve Kagan held in Green Bay on the Farm Bill. It was 2 hours. It was very well attended forum, and he's the only member of the Wisconsin delegation on the Agriculture Committee. So,
not a freshman on the Ag Committee. That's right. Yeah.
That's right. I was really heartened. I'm a member of Bread for the World, which is a hunger organization. So my interest in the Farm Bill is how it affects poverty and how it affects hunger. But a lot of the people there were in the farm organizations and food organizations. They came up with a lot of support for a lot of the things that Bread for the World is also supporting, transitioning from commodities to more green programs, energy research, the nutrition programs that are a big part of the Farm Bill, helping new farmers, because there are twice as many farmers over age 65 as under 35.
There you go.
And then rural development, where they mentioned it's not just farms. 96% of the income in rural areas is from non-farm sources. So rural development needs to include a lot more than just farms. And people can get a lot more information from Bread for the World at bread.org about all this.
I thank you very much for calling, Beth. And Brad, a comment from you?
Well, yeah, no, I really appreciate the work that she's personally doing there and that our organization is doing. It's obviously very critical. I mean, the nutrition programs, things like food stamps, like school lunches, that takes over half of the entire USDA budget each year. So that is obviously an incredibly integral part of the Farm Bill, and it's a part that needs to be maintained, no question. The other point she's talking about is that we're discovering, too, when conducting forums around the country that Isaac Walton League is doing, that there is incredible broad-based support for a lot of things in the Farm Bill that cuts across interest groups. And conservation and rural development is one of those things. And we spent a lot of the time in our report, too, fleshing out details about how traditional subsidy systems where they pay producers for how much they produce without any limit, unfortunately, through some loopholes that are provided, is just really driving overproduction and driving down price, and that drives down a worldwide price in specific commodities, absent any other influences of really market disruptions or weather instances, that sort of thing. And what that in turn does is not provide really any economic benefit to communities. In fact, the Federal Reserve Bank and the USDA both have literature which shows and research that shows that current production systems or commodity subsidies for production actually have resulted in the consolidation of farms and less population in rural areas. The good news on the other side of it is that things that they call natural amenities, and these are, you know, just opportunities for outdoor recreation, the ability to go a community to have for people to go fishing, to go hunting, to go horseback riding, what have you. These things they define as natural amenities are directly correlated with both population retention and growth in rural communities. It's directly correlated with job retention and growth. And in fact, and perhaps most surprising, it's directly correlated with numbers of farms retention and growth.
Mm-hmm.
So it is through resources of enhancing conservation on the land and really, you know, enhancing the natural amenities, these rural green space, if you will, that actually drives economic opportunity in rural America, because as the caller said, it's not necessarily being that rural development is not necessarily coming directly out of a grain field.
Yeah. I thank you very much, Beth. It's bread.org, correct?
Yes, that's right.
All right, we'll learn some more from there. And by the way, what about your website, Brad?
It's iwla.org. And the report on our Farm Bill is right on the front page there.
iwla.org.
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks again, Beth. By the way, if you'd like to join in with your question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. And Susan in Summit's been patiently waiting. Susan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for talking to me.
Sure.
Our property adjoins property owned by the Isaac Walton League. And it is currently being used by a hunt club. And I've been told that, as a matter of fact, they have an easement on our property to get back to the property that they use for their hunt club. But I know it doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the Isaac Walton League. And I've heard through farmers that they're planning on planting that land in crops so that they have less of a payment or something like that. But I'm just curious how that works, how the land that actually is owned by the Isaac Walton League is managed.
Well, I unfortunately can't speak to that specific. I'm not familiar with the instance, and I apologize for that. I'd like to be able to answer that question much more directly. The Isaac Walton League does have local chapters. We have 15 local chapters in Wisconsin, and they will often, if not and not all the cases, but often have property land and a property clubhouse that the chapter is based within. The management of that land is certainly for conservation purposes. That those are, you know, it's kind of a wide definition, and it can be applied in a lot of different ways. But certainly from the league's perspective, it is a much more limited definition, perhaps, than others might be able to provide, because we want to see certainly, you know, the effort to not only kind of pilot project and demonstrate different conservation practices with the land that the league does have control over, that can be then, you know, broadcast out more widely and other people to take advantage of that same type of thing. In the specific instance you describe, I don't know the details. It sounds like something of there's some potential concern there. All right, I can certainly get in touch with the state division of the Isaac Walton League that oversees the local chapters and kind of pursue that question further.
Okay, I was just wondering who I could contact to find out more about it.
I can certainly track that down for you. Why don't I give out a phone number and an email for me? Would that be appropriate?
Sure, yeah. You can do that.
Okay. The phone number is 651-649-1446. Or you may email me. It's BREDLIN, so BREDLIN at IWLA.org.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And I assume that, you know, if people have questions, there's probably a spot on your IWLA.org website where people can send in questions as well.
Yeah, you can look up local states and their websites so you can get closer to your home chapters and home divisions there.
And again, if you want to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Any other concerns that you have, loopholes, anything in the current law that you worry about or wonder about?
Well, we have some primary concerns. I can say at the outset that as we look at this reauthorization of this new farm bill, the 2007 farm bill, it's a reauthorization of the 2002 farm bill. As I mentioned before, they go in about five-year cycles generally. We don't actually advocate the elimination of any existing programs in the farm bill, and in fact, we don't advocate the addition of any new programs, but we certainly advocate for some corrections and tweaking, I guess, if you will, of what currently exists. A couple of those things that are pretty glaring to us are the fact that the 2002 Farm Bill was largely heralded as a conservation farm bill, as a reinvestment in rural conservation and protection, obviously, of soil, air, and water for our nation, to the tune of $9 billion additional spending authorized and put into statute in that 2002 Farm Bill. Unfortunately, there became some cuts to conservation immediately out of the box through the annual appropriation cycle in Congress, where appropriators get together each year and actually authorize what the or appropriate what is actually going to be spent for that year's budget. And from the very first year, conservation programs have received cuts. In fact, that $9 billion was promised over a 10-year cycle. Well, we're 5 years into it now, and $5 billion of that has already been cut out of conservation. So that's caused us some real concern and heartburn. And one of the proposals, or certainly one of the focuses we have in this next Farm Bill, is to recommit to that that commitment that was made to conservation in the prior Farm Bill, and that we have to live up to the promises that were made and achieve the real advantages that conservation can do, as I was describing earlier, in the sense of it has real economic impact on rural communities. This is, you know, studied and asserted from financial resources, like I said, the Federal Reserve Bank, from agriculture agencies, the USDA, in fact, even the state of Iowa, a state that all of us kind of probably imagine as one of the most agricultural states you're going to find. They found the same results in a university study there, that their counties with the higher degree of natural amenities are the ones that had higher farms, better rural incomes, et cetera. So we think that it's really short-sighted of Congress to be making those cuts to conservation, when in fact it's the one thing that could really produce some real good in rural America economically and certainly environmentally.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, about compliance, conservation compliance. How do we maximize that?
Well, that's a real important issue, and the conservation compliance is kind of a broad term, but it really relates to some specific policy in the Federal Farm Bill. And what that is, it's the way I describe it is it's pretty logical covenant between the public and the producer. And what it says is that if you're accepting payments from USDA for your crop production subsidy or for even participation in conservation programs, the public is going to attach to that some expectation of abiding by some basic conservation rules. These are commonly referred to as sod busters, swamp busters, that sort of thing. What they really are is it says that if you're participating in the Farm Bill programs, receiving payments from the public, then you will not adhere to your conservation plan for farming highly erodible land if you have highly erodible land in your farm. It says that you will not drain a wetland if you have a wetland on your farm. The problem that we've seen, it's been identified very starkly in a report from the Government Accountability Office, is that where there are citations made under conservation compliance, which a violation entails removing or reducing the subsidies that would otherwise go to that farm. So in other words, if the farmer, say, does drain a wetland that should not have been drained, the response of conservation compliance is, well, we will withhold your payment as penalty for not abiding by the conservation compliance rules. Unfortunately, the Government Accountability Office found that in 80% of the cases, those violations were waived upon appeal. Now, there can be certainly good reasons for some of those waivers. We don't know. It's the GAO also reported that they couldn't find really good paper trails and justification for why waivers are permitted. So that's one thing that we certainly have to look at. The additional component, too, is that, again, very starkly demonstrated in the GAO report, is that the number of violations that are being written, the citations being given, have dramatically dropped. And they cite in their interviews with USDA personnel that when they see, unfortunately, 80% of the citations that they are issued being waived, it provides very little incentive to go out and write additional ones. And so those are areas that really need correction. And we propose maybe statewide independent review boards where we have independent people can come in and examine a situation and see whether the waivers themselves were appropriately justified or not, and make sure that runs just a little bit more efficiently and actually really fulfills that, a real logical covenant between the public and the producer when they are participating and receiving public money.
Yeah, and we don't know, or do we know, how many people or how many farms are actually in compliance? What percent?
We don't really know, I guess, in that respect. I'm not sure if I can pull that down, but the compliance, and waivers can be issued for very appropriate reasons, and some of them are, say, well, this waiver says you've got 1 year to correct the problem that you have, and it may have been the result of just not simply knowing that you were in violation or not knowing that a particular practice placed a farmer into violation. And in those cases, certainly, we support the effort to provide the opportunity to correct the problems. It's not just the goal to punishment is not the goal. It's conservation
right.
is the goal. And of course, that does make the compliance component of federal policy very controversial, because this is the stick without the carrot portion of conservation. This is, you know, the penalty phase for conservation, and it's you know, somewhat resented on that level. So it's where you have programs like a conservation reserve program and many others we could talk about that really provide incentives to the farmer to participate in conservation. The role of conservation compliance in the sense of being a penalty instrument is I think necessary, but
yeah.
certainly it's not the only approach to conservation, and we certainly wouldn't advocate that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what can we do to invest more in conservation?
Well, yes, as we said, we really need to fulfill that commitment that was made 5 years ago, and we also know that the budget for agriculture right now is actually being reduced rather than expanded from where we were 5 years ago. So what we've got is some real challenging times on our hands in terms of finding additional money for conservation or for anything in the Farm Bill. And we've certainly looked at that as we approach the Farm Bill as well at the League and putting together our analysis and platform. And we've identified a few areas. One of those things I just talked about, conservation compliance. If we have 80% waivers being issued and some large percentage of those are, let's assume, valid, the actual withholding of payments are actually a savings then that is going unrealized right now. And that's one way to obtain more money, and it's only appropriate if violations are being committed and not being receiving the rule of law that they should in terms of withholding payments or reducing payments. That should be occurring because it is a promise that is made and should be kept, so we can really achieve more savings that way. And in particular, when we talk about the subsidization of crop production to begin with, USDA really sets pretty strong criteria around how that's done. And in fact, it results in just five crops, that's corn, cotton, wheat, rice, and soybean, receiving 90% of all the payments for crop production in the country. If you produce apples, you don't get subsidized to grow it. If you produce corn, cotton, wheat, rice, and soybeans, you get subsidized to produce it. Consequently, those crops are certainly have shaped rural areas and rural communities in terms of what the production is, what the infrastructure is like, you know, even what the transportation systems are like. But the problem being that subsidizing those crops is referred to as a safety net. And a safety net in the commodity title, in the crop subsidization portion of the Farm Bill, is something the League frankly supports, because what the safety net says is that when prices drop extremely low, the government will step in and make up the difference between what the low market price is and what a target price they set, a loan rate or a countercyclical target price is that they set. And we think that's appropriate. But for a safety net functioning on that based on a low-price environment and making up the difference really requires a maximum point at which payments stop.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have that, what you're really doing then is saying the more you grow, the more money you make. We're driving increased production. And as you well know, the environment that creates low prices invariably, historically, is an environment of surplus production. So
yep.
if you're driving production, you're driving down prices. So anyway, what the League is saying is that we need to close these caps that exist or and put in place caps that actually limit the amount by which government payments can be received by any individual farm operation, so that there's not this open-ended drive for production.
Well, and on that note, we have to conclude today. Brad, I thank you so much, and I want to remind people to go to the website, iwla.org. You'll find out more about the Isaac Walton League, but you'll also find out a lot more about that 2007 Farm Bill and their analysis of it. Brad, thanks again. Appreciate it.
Well, I sure appreciate it, Larry. Thanks so much for having me on.
Brad Redlin of the Isaac Walton League of America. And thank you for listening. Stay with us.